the positive
763
in the other one.
Okay, but we are starting with the paragraph, this possibility.
That's correct, yes.
From the certitude.
Yes.
Okay. So, actually, by this time, Sri Aurobindo is coming to the conclusion of his chapter. So, he has introduced already all the various arguments that he wanted to present us with. And he is rounding up his conclusions. And we can take a pause for a moment and consider the basis of his presentation. Part of it is quite complex because he is considering all the various theories concerning rebirth that exist in the popular imagination, as well as in a variety of spiritual philosophies, as well as in traditions other than India, and he is pointing to an inevitability, almost a logical necessity in a certain view. But if we cut to the central core of his argument, we can see it like this, that there are some basic perceptions and intuitions that we find in our experience of the universe. One of them is the master of evolution. Now, the master idea of evolution has been forefronted in modern times in evolutionary biology. But that has only considered the evolution of material forms and tied this evolution of material forms to a certain necessity which relates to the survival of species. Now, if we look, however, if we are not blinded by that exclusive consideration, then we can see that not merely are forms evolving, but consciousness is also evolving. Now, the evolution of consciousness can also be seen to have a number of dimensions to it. Firstly, there are forms of consciousness. Just as we can talk about material forms, forms of bodies which are material, so too we can talk of non-material forms of consciousness, or bodies which are not physical bodies, but vital bodies and mental bodies. So there is an evolution of consciousness in terms of some kind of a vessel of consciousness. Not only material vessels, but non-material vessels as well. Secondly, there is an evolution of universal consciousness that we can see in the fact that nature presents us with these gradations of universal manifestation, a material manifestation. I think some music was playing or something. Okay, so we see a manifestation of gradations of consciousness, of universe of matter, a universe of life, a universe of mind, or a manifestation of these forms of consciousness. So if we are to make sense of the fact that there is an evolution taking place, not just an evolution of material forms, but of other forms of consciousness, an evolution of consciousness itself, both in forms as well as in universal gradations, then our explanation of an evolution of forms is not sufficient. Some kind of a mechanism is at work. And this fits into Sri Aurobindo's idea about an involution of consciousness and a gradual appearance out of that involution of the forms of consciousness evolving towards some ultimate consciousness. Now, if that were only the case, then we could say that there is an evolution of consciousness and of forms taking place, but these are universal in nature, that there is a certain kind of principle that is evolving. However, we find that not only is there a principle that is evolving, but gradually in this evolution of the principle of consciousness, there is the emergence of greater and greater sense of personhood, an evolution of personhood that is taking place. And in the individual, at the human level, this sense of being a person has come to the forefront, so much so that the individual person wants to be the master of his destiny, not only in a kind of a, in a sense, subject to the universe, but also in a sense of being master of the instruments of nature, master of the condition of consciousness. So, in a way, individuality, the emergence of the individual person, is something very, very powerful in this factor of evolution of forms and of consciousness. So these are the various phenomenological elements that we need to take into consideration when we talk about evolution. And if this is the case, then this emergence of the person must be connected in some way with this entire process of evolution of consciousness. If that is to be, the only way that can be is if this personhood is the center of the evolution. In other words, in each form of consciousness, a person is trying to emerge, which is one of the self-conceptions of a divine person. A divine person, a Purushottama, is exploring its own potentialities as infinite person forms of personhood. And each one of these is evolving in this universe, out of an inconscience towards some ultimate consciousness and knowledge of itself. This is the basis of the theory of rebirth. To arrive at that kind of an evolution of personhood, there has to be the lapse of the Supreme Person into an impersonality and an inconscience. That is the beginning. Out of that, consciousness emerges, though there is still a general pervasive condition of impersonality. Out of that, gradually greater and greater personality emerges, along with the emergence of greater and greater grades and forms of consciousness. In all this, the emergence of the person has to follow a succession, because it cannot but be the eternal, persistent individual that is gradually evolving into its own self-possession and mastery of the process of evolving consciousness. That is the basis of the theory of rebirth. So, in a sense, that kind of explanation that Sri Aurobindo gives us ties together all the various perceptions that we have of the evolving universe, the evolving consciousness, the evolving forms of consciousness, as well as of the emergence of the individual as a powerful agent transforming its own existence and becoming master of the evolving consciousness. Now, in terms of the Indian theory, one may say that this double evolution is what Sri Aurobindo is proposing, a double evolution. That is an evolution of Prakriti as well as of Purusha. Evolution of Prakriti, and both of these are foregrounded by an involution. That's why such an involution, Sri Aurobindo has used the term holocaust. He has talked about the holocaust of the Purusha and the holocaust of the Prakriti. In the work The Mother, he has used this term, the holocaust of the Prakriti. He says, this is sometimes called the holocaust of the Purusha, but more so, much more so, is it the holocaust of the Prakriti, the sacrifice of the Divine Mother. Okay? So this double sacrifice, the Purusha Medha Yajna, as well as the sacrifice of the Divine Mother, is at the very base of this evolving universe. The sacrifice of the Divine Mother is what creates the ground of conscience. And the universal condition of the emergence of consciousness. It is the Divine Mother's sacrifice that fragments Purusha into its innumerable possible particles and creates this kind of a possibility at various levels of impersonal universal consciousness and its forms. She gives the various forms, the adharas, into which the vessel, into which the forms of consciousness will enter. And at first, these forms of consciousness are also her forms in the sense that they are impersonal. But at the same time, in every one of these vessels, down to the most subatomic particle of matter, Purusha is also present. Purusha is present as the soul entity, the psychic entity, the evolving person is present from the very beginning in every particle of Prakritic manifestation. As Sri Aurobindo has a beautiful poem in which he talks about the atom as Shiva's minute, minuscule chariot. That itself, the electron, I think the name of the poem is Electron. It talks about the electron as the infinitesimal chariot of Shiva, because that indeed is what it is. It is a habitation, it is a body of Prakriti and a form of universal consciousness, material consciousness, which is a form of Prakriti. But at the same time, it houses, as everything else houses, an aspect of Purusha, of person, of the divine person, of Purushottama. So that is the double evolution that is going on. On the one hand, we think about Prakriti that is evolving, and Prakriti in the tantric sense is at the very base of the evolution as a coiled serpent energy. In the Puranic sense, this is the serpent Shesha or Anantanaga on which Vishnu sleeps and whose coils form the basis of the manifestation. In the individualized form, it is the Kundalini Shakti which is coiled as Prakriti at the base of every individual existence causing the evolution of Prakriti to take place. But at the same time, there is also another aspect of divinity, which is the transcendental Purushottama implanted into every form of Prakriti as the psychic entity. Now, not only is there the psychic entity, because that is an immersion of Purushottama in Prakriti, but guiding the possibilities of the infinite emergence of personhood out of Prakriti is one aspect of Purusha which is eternally free above. This is Akshara Purusha. We have Shara Purusha and Akshara Purusha as the two foibles set up by Purushottama in his emergence out of inconscience into the full possession of his own reality above. So guiding the evolutionary part from life to life in its succession of rebirths, bringing into existence its various possibilities as it grows towards its fullness, is the Akshara Purusha or Jivatman, and emerging from life to life as the being immersed in Prakriti, the person immersed in Prakriti, is the psychic entity or Antaratman, which at the level of the human being makes a radical jump and emerges as the beginnings of the typal form of Purushottam in the manifestation, that is, as the psychic being or Chaitya Purusha. Now, beyond this, there are other stages into which this psychic being must move, and that is how its evolution will continue. And Sri Aurobindo ends that last paragraph which we studied by pointing out that the human soul has not reached the culmination, but even when it does so, the culmination of psychic evolution will not have been reached. That's where that wonderful line with which she ends, that to be beyond this initial culmination, a greater flowering of the spirit in the human life, of which we have as yet only the first intimations. The imperfection of man is not the last word of nature, but his perfection too is not the last peak of the spirit. Yes,
I had a question about towards the end you talked about a type of something in the evolution. And I thought that type of meant spin it to wall.
Yeah, I actually used that term not in that sense, and I need to clarify that the word typal can be thought of as non-evolutionary. And there is reality to that as well, in the sense that we spoke of last time about the universal Manu, for example, Vishwa Manav, or Purusha in any one of these various strands of consciousness. In other words, as Prakriti evolves its universal possibilities, there is a universal or typal Purusha connected with each one of these universal possibilities. But the individual aspect of Purushottama present in every evolving entity is not that typal being, is not that type of Purusha. But I use the word typo to talk about the emergence of the psychic being at a certain stage in the evolution, with the appearance of the human being. With the appearance of the human being, the psychic entity takes a form which has a certain kind of typal quality to it. So that is the human psychic being. Now, human psychic being is not the last word of the psychic entity's evolution or the psychic being's evolution. Psychic being will move on to formulate an existence for itself which is beyond the human, which is first over-mental and then supramental and perhaps even beyond that. But nevertheless, it takes a certain form when the human being makes its appearance, and that form is a typal form, not a non-evolutionary typal form, but typal in the sense that it has a certain species characteristic, the characteristic of the human psychic being. So in that sense, I use the term typal, but that is not to be confused with the idea of the typal being which is non-evolutionary and which can also be thought of as, you know, either the gods or the various cosmic purushas that are related to the various cosmic prakritis in the evolution of consciousness.
Well, thank you for clearing that up. I have to think about it. Well, thank you.
Can I ask you a question here?
Yeah.
The Jivatman is the Akshara Purusha, and
yes.
With the emergence of the psychic being, you said there is a human type of being, but in between, there is also the psychic entity. Now, the Jivatman becomes several psychic entities, which individually formulate or form the psychic being life after life. Is that right?
Repeat the last part of your question, Anjali, please.
The Jivatman, which is one spirit, which is the Akshara Purusha, from there come out these psychic entities. And these psychic entities formulate their individual typal psychic beings. Is that right? Because
you know,
the entity...
The Jivatman is not a single being. The Jivatman is already the multiple self-concentration of Supreme Atman. In other words, each psychic being has connected with it a Jivatman. So, you see, Jivatman is already the Atman of the Jiva. It's the individualized Atman. And so, what is happening is that the divine is what Sri Aurobindo calls in the Life Divine a multi-form being. In other words, one being who is looking at himself in infinite ways. Each one of these ways of conceiving himself is an Atma, is a Jivatman. Okay? So we can talk about Paramatman as the one being, but Paramatman self-conceptions are the Jivatmans. Now, Jivatman is a static self-conception, but to use the word static is not really very accurate in the divine sense, because we're talking of infinite self-perceptions of the infinite being. In other words, each one of these self-perceptions is infinite in itself. So the Jivatmans have infinite possibilities. They're only perspectives on the infinite. Okay, so each one of them has an infinite possibility. Now, how is this infinite possibility going to be employed in, as an evolutionary form? If that is how Jivatman will sort of guide its own evolution in time. So So from a certain point of view, there is no difference between psychic entity and Jivatman. They are the same being in two operations of consciousness, one temporal and the other eternal. So from that point of view, they are the same being. But from the point of view of the avidya, which deliberately needs to divide its own perceptions into different forms of experience, Jivatman is the static, eternal experience of the individual soul, and Antaratman is the evolving experience of the individual soul. So this evolving individuality arrives at a certain point, guided by the Jivatman, which already knows from beforehand what succession will be taken. It arrives at a certain point where it makes a leap and evolves the psychic being, a Chaitya Purusha. That is the formal, appearance of the psychic entity taking possession of a prakriti which is related to the human consciousness.
Thank you so much. Can we just say that the Jivatman, instead of using the word static, if we say that Jivatman is the unborn status, and psychic entity is that which is born, which then creates the psychic being. Can we say that then?
Yes, you can say that. You can say that.
Jivatman is the unborn.
Yes, it remains unborn because it is atemporal, it is eternal, outside of time, while the psychic entity is the same reality perceived as a succession of evolving forms in time. Because Jivatman as unborn has infinite potentiality. So how is this potentiality going to manifest? That manifestation occurs in time as the various successions of evolving psychic forms. And at a certain point, that evolution brings up the psychic being.
Thank you so much.
Devashishta.
Oops.
Yes, Mom.
Okay. Yeah, here, what is the meaning exactly of kshara? Kshara, the way I understood it, is does it mean destructible or does it just mean changeable?
Yeah, literally it means mutable. That which can change is mutable. And now the sense of destructible has come into it, because if it can change, that means its form is not permanent. Its form is getting destroyed, you see. So from that point of view, Shara takes on the sense of destructible, but it, in its original meaning, what it means is mutable, that which changes.
Okay, thank you.
Devashishta, going back to the previous discussion for a second, could you talk about could you place the Jivatman and Antaratman in perspective of the with the triple transformation? Like I understand that in the psychic transformation is when one comes in contact with a psychic being. So similarly, is it possible to map the Antaratman and Jivatman to the other two transformations, or are they irrelevant in that model?
No, they're not irrelevant. They're very relevant. You see, the psychic transformation, when we talk about the triple transformation, the first transformation itself, the psychic transformation, is very intimately related to this discussion of the philosophy of rebirth, in the sense of the true emergence of the person as the master of the natural instruments. Because if indeed that is the very meaning of evolution and of the rebirth, the very meaning is that the Purushottam is trying to emerge in individual personal forms, then the first real emergence that takes place is in the human being as the master of the human instruments. So human form, both of nature, human prakriti, human physical, mental, and vital forms of habitation, and human purusha, which is what we have talked about as the Vishwamanav or the Manu, are both in a sense the typal forms that the psychic being is going to integrate and master. Psychic being becomes fully aware of itself as the master of this universal form known as the human prakriti. And in doing so, it identifies itself as the universal human purusha or Vishwa Manav. Now, beyond this, this is not its stopping point, because ultimately psychic being is a portion or a aspect, a self-conception of Purushottama. Purushottama is emerging in time through psychic being. Therefore, psychic being is going to proceed onward and know itself even more fully as the Purusha, the cosmic Purusha, beyond the human, merely the human Purusha, the cosmic divine Purusha, in the open mental consciousness. So at that point, the individualization of the cosmic Purusha takes place in every individual. That is the second transformation. That is actually the first aspect of the second transformation. The psychic being takes its station as the universal of cosmic Purusha, the over-mental Purusha. The next stage of the second transformation is the transformation of the Prakriti, again, the physical, mental, and vital sheaths, into the over-mental Purusha's sheaths, transformed and mastered completely as manifesting instruments of the over-mental Purusha in an individual form or individualized form. Third step is the psychic being taking its station as the supramental Purusha, identified with the supramental Purusha, and turning that power towards the transformation again of physical, vital, and mental, and higher still, nature forms, completely mastered and identified with as its own personal instrument. Okay, so that is how the triple transformation relates to these universal planes and the evolution of universal consciousness, both in terms of prakriti as well as of purusha.
Thank you, Devashishtha.
Devashish?
Yes, it's been.
You talked about forms when they become mutable, they lose their form.
Yeah, I said mutable when we talk about. Yes, Vince, you want to complete your thought?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I talked about what is called the Shara Purusha, or the mutable being inside the creation, immersed in the creation, as that which. Whose forms are destroyed. Destroyed in the sense that in this movement of evolution from form to form, whatever form the psychic being or the psychic entity assumes is superseded and becomes something else. So when it becomes something else, what it was before is in that sense destroyed. So that is the way in which it is destructible, just as it is also mutable.
I get it. Okay. No, thank you very much. I get it.
Can I ask you a question, please?
I just wanted
to know whether the two words that are talked of in the Mundaka Upanishad, can we relate the two as the psychic entity and the psychic being?
In the Mundaka Upanishad.
Yes.
Can you
talk about the bird?
Oh, the two birds you're talking about.
Yes, the two birds in the Mundaka Upanishad.
Yeah, you see the two birds in the Mundaka Upanishad as symptomatic of the Upanishads. These are often deaf, mysterious, and they can often be construed in a variety of ways. Now, as you see, the description of two birds is that one sits, you know, without doing anything, and the other eats of the fruit, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
This can certainly be a description of the two Purushas, the Akshara and the Shara Purusha. It could also be a description of the traditional notion of Purusha and Prakriti. That is, Purusha as the witness and master of Prakriti, and Prakriti as the doer of things, you see. So it could be both or either of these. From our point of view, if you think of it, because the example given talks about the enjoyment of the fruit. So the enjoyer, the real enjoyer of experience in the house of Prakriti is the psychic entity. So we may say, perhaps more properly, that the two birds are the Akshara Purusha and the Shara Purusha.
And we could call them the psychic entity is the Akshara, I mean the one of the birds, and the psychic being is the other bird, because the psychic entity is really not participating, while the psychic entity is not participating, just like the other bird, and one bird which is participating is the psychic being.
No, I wouldn't exactly put it like that. I'd say, you know, not the psychic entity and the psychic being. The psychic entity is participating, though not in an individualized form until the human being. But it is participating. Its memory may not sort of be as distinct as the memory of its own formation as psychic being, but it is really more correct to say that the bird that does not participate is the Akshara Purusha, is the Jivatman. And the bird that participates is the Shara Purusha, whether as psychic entity or as being.
Okay. Thank you so much.
No, that was me.
At the ashram in the museum, or whatever you call it, those two or three rooms of Sri Aurobindo's and the mother's possessions, they have Sri Aurobindo's typewriter. In an example of what he's, you know, there's a sheet of what he's typing, and it has that very story about the two birds on it.
Actually, I have a book, M.P. Pandit's book. On the cover, this picture of two birds is given, and Sri Aurobindo's translation of that verse is given. Just wanted to read the translation so that, we can...
Yes, yes, why don't you read it, please, yes.
Yeah. Two birds, beautiful of wing, close companions, cling to one common tree. Of the two, one eats the sweet fruit of the tree, the other eats not, watches his fellow. The soul is the bird that sits immersed on the one common tree, but because he is not the Lord, he is bewildered and has sorrow. But when he sees the other who is the Lord and beloved, he knows that all his greatness and his sorrow passes away from him. This is the translation by Sri Aurobindo.
Yeah.
The name of the book is Wisdom of Upanishads. This is a compilation by M.P. Pandit.
Mm-hmm.
Devashishda,
Yes.
So going back just a bit to what you were saying about the Jivatman is the one not participating, so to say. So
yeah.
When we say that, what do we understand by the word participate? Do we mean that the poise of the Jivatman itself is as it is, and it's only the psychic through the evolution, it has the experience of the experience of the Jivatman. So it's not that the Jivatman is doing anything, so to say. It's only the psychic and which is evolving and attaining to the Jivatman. Is that what we mean?
Yeah, it's actually not really attaining to the Jivatman. The Jivatman is, you know, as that verse Sitaram read out in that verse, the Jivatman is the already liberated voice of the soul. So psychic being is the immersed part of that same experience. So there is the experiencer of the evolution is the psychic being, while the blueprint of the evolution of the evolving soul is kept, one may say, in the Jivatman. Now, the experiencer can at any point know its own freedom, because forever it is always free, always already free, you may say, as the Jivatman. So now, question of whether it is evolving into the Jivatman or not, that is a very interesting question. It is not actually evolving into the Jivatman, because the form of the psychic being's evolution is always that of experience in time, while the form of the experience or reality of the Jivatman is always that of a static, unborn blueprint outside of time. So it is not that the psychic being is evolving into the Jivatman. The psychic being is evolving into a condition in which it will know itself to be both the experience in time as well as the static experience outside of time. This dual poise cannot be had in the avidya. It can only be had in the vidya or in the supermind. So at that point, it knows itself as one self-conception of the Purushottama, who is both Akshara Purusha and Shara Purusha, and can experience himself as both at the same time. The psychic being is moving towards that kind of an experience.
Is that like the universal and the transcendent?
No. Universal and the transcendent. Universal is a certain kind of a poise in which one experiences freedom. Universal Purusha is an experience of freedom from the universal Prakriti, but still it is constrained by the laws. It is free within the laws of the universal Prakriti. Transcendent means that it can create the laws of Prakriti. It can change the laws of Prakriti. You see, to have power over the entire universal movement, not merely accepting the movement and having power over it, but being able to create it. That is the power of transcendence.
Okay.
Devishishta? Oh, sorry. Does the Jivatman in any way represent the pure existent aspect of Satchidananda, that is the Sat aspect within us?
Yes, you could say that. You could say that it represents the Sat aspect with the others latent within it.
The others latent within it. Okay.
Yeah, Chit and Ananda latent within it.
Okay. Thank you.
Sri Aurobindo is saying that actually Sat in its absolute is represented in the universe as matter, because matter is pure being. It is being in which consciousness is latent. See, so in spirit, you may, Sat may be represented as, now let me go one step further. So that is a universal manifestation in the ignorance of Sat is the plane of matter. Okay? Similarly, universal, manifestation of Chit is the plane of consciousness, the power of consciousness within matter, evolving its various modalities. And universal manifestation of Ananda is the individualized form of the psychic being. Because in a way, Ananda plane gets its greatest reality from the Purusha, Anandamaya Purusha. Now, Anandamaya Purusha is that which has multiplied itself as innumerable Akshara Purushas and Shara Purushas, which is the psychic being. Psychic being is really an embodiment of Ananda Purusha and Ananda Prakriti. So what we find is that again has got different aspects of Sat and Chit to it, Sat, Chit and Ananda to it. And if we want to look at the Sat aspect of the soul, that may be seen as the Akshara Purusha.
So, excuse me, Devashish?
Yes.
So you could back up the Chit part of it and go back into the unmanifest.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Oh, thank you.
Yes, I think shall we continue with our reading today?
Yes.
Debashita, I have a question.
Okay.
Just like the individual, the ultimate state of the individual is Purushottama. So can we say the ultimate state of Prakriti is the Divine Mother?
Yes, undoubtedly.
But
I missed out what you said.
I mean the ultimate state of the individual, the psychic being, is Purushottama. Yes. Same way the ultimate state of Prakriti is the Divine Mother. So in my image, the Purusha is the central core and the Prakriti is the sheath. So is it just an image that
yes.
breaks down when we go to the level of Purushottama and Mother? Because they are one, right? It's not that Mother is the sheath.
Yeah, they are one, but you see, for manifestation, they are two. So that is the paradox of reality in the supermind, is that from the very beginning and always and eternally so, there is one and there are two. Because that is the very meaning of manifestation. Manifestation cannot take place unless the one knows itself as two. Now, philosophically speaking, this is possible as part of the mystery and paradox of infinite being. because infinity is the, it's one of the properties of infinity is what that beautiful hymn of the Purna. That is, if you take infinity out of infinity, infinity remains. So you see, Purusha cannot see its own end. You see, there is no end to it. When it looks at itself, when it mirrors itself, what it sees is infinity. Just as that same infinity, when it looks at Purusha, what it sees is infinity. This is the reason why duality is intrinsic to the reality of infinite being. Unity and duality are both coexisting truths in the supermind. And that's why it is, Sri Aurobindo calls it the two in one. See, so even in supermind, you know this ultimate absolute unity of Purusha Prakriti or Ishvara Shakti, but at the same time, you also know them to be absolutely two. See, both are true.
Okay, so there's the other image of the dot, right? The bindu.
Yes.
So the problem there is that it's dimensionless. So it is difficult to conceive of two there.
Yes, but bindu is more properly a symbol of being, of pure being. So in other words, bindu is the center. Yes, you can conceive of it as bindu can be conceived of as a divine soul, Paramatman. So in a sense, what we might say is if infinite being conceives of itself as a person, that is the bindu. It ultimately boils down to some central being at the center of the entire universe. But you see, idea of bindu again, it's just like, you know, in nature, all these things are repeated as symbols. Bindu is also split. Even in the tantric idea, bindu is split into two. Even though it is dimensionless, again, that is a paradox. In that it is dimensionless, therefore it is omnipresent. It is a being, and yet it is omnipresent. You see, it is locationless. But at the same time, one of its paradoxes is that in its dimensionlessness, it is also dual.
Okay, it all boils down to experiencing that, right? I mean, as long as we are trying to use with the reason which is the instrument of division, it will remain ungraspable.
Yes, undoubtedly. And even in experience, this is the thing that Sri Aurobindo is pointing out, that even in experience, we can experience each of these things that we are mentally conceiving of as truths separately. And when we experience them separately, we go ahead and say that is the truth. Not only in mind, but even in experience, they may exist as separate truths. So long as we are having our experience within the domain of the mental Purusha. And I'm not talking of the individual mental Purusha, but the cosmic mental Purusha. So long as the experience is had within that domain, each of these can be experienced as an individual truth. It is only when one rises into the supermind that it is possible to have the experience of unity and duality at the same time.
Thank you, Debashista.
Yeah, actually, this discussion is in fact a very, very important one, because it relates to the whole problem of unity of religions. And it also relates to the famous statement of the Veda, which is repeated so many times that there is one truth, but the sages conceive of it differently. See, the problem is that this kind of statement and this idea of universality of religion cannot be really experienced until one gets outside of the domain of mind, into supermind. And this is the point Sri Aurobindo is making. It's not very easy to understand, because one, in the, you know, sort of, you know, you have all these so-called conferences on religious unity, etc. And it is better for these religions to be separate, because each one of them is affirming some truth which is unique and which is one of the ways in which spirit experiences itself. But at the same time, it is possible to arrive at another pose of being in which all these are existing separately, and yet they are experienced as poses of the one. That can only be outside of the map of mind in supermind.
Vincent, would you like to read?
Sure, I'll do that. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. This possibility becomes a certitude if the present leading principle of the mind, as man has developed it, the intellect, is not its highest principle. If mind itself has other powers, as yet only imperfectly possessed by the highest types of the human individual, then a prolongation of the line of evolution, and consequently of the ascending line of a rebirth to embody them, is inevitable. If supermind also is a power of consciousness concealed here in the evolution, the line of rebirth cannot stop even there. It cannot cease in its ascent before the mental has been replaced by the supramental nature, and an embodied supramental being becomes the leader of the terrestrial existence. Should I go on?
Maybe just to pause for a moment, to draw attention to the fact that when he begins by saying this possibility becomes a certitude, the possibility he's talking about there is related to what he introduces as the highest ideals or types of humanity in the previous paragraph. Remember, he had talked there about a Socrates or a Shankara. And then he went on to speak about the fact that even a Socrates and a Shankara may not be the culmination of even the human cycle. So as far as the human cycle is concerned, there too here he's making the point that we may not even have explored in its completeness the possibilities of mind. And as he has pointed out elsewhere, huge ranges of mind remain beyond our access as present human beings. This is one of the amazing things, really awe-inspiring things about Sri Aurobindo, in the sense that humanity in its evolution has managed to access a range of consciousness that is a minuscule part of what even the human mind is capable of. And Sri Aurobindo has really mapped that entire range and has gone beyond it. And the point he's making over here is whatever we consider to be the highest achievements of human beings, a Plato or a Shankara, is even there only a very small range compared to what humanity itself can achieve. That's the point he's making about this possibility. This possibility relates to the fact that there may be beyond this initial culmination a greater flowering of the spirit in the human life, of which we have as yet only the first intimations. So that becomes a certitude. If the present leading principle of the mind, as man has developed it, the intellect, is not its highest principle. And there he goes on to hint at those ranges of the mind that he has explored elsewhere. If mind itself has other powers, as yet only imperfectly possessed by the highest types of human individuals, then a prolongation of the line of evolution and consequently of the ascending line of rebirth to embody them is inevitable. In other words, we have to go through the process of rebirth to manifest a humanity that is in greater possession of universal ranges of mind, of higher mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, and ultimately of overmind. And it is there where the human cycle will complete itself. It is ultimately in a cosmic being, and in a sense, the second of the triple transformations, that the human cycle will complete itself. But the possibilities of the psychic will not complete itself even there. And that's what he's saying in the next line, which is, if supermind also is a power of consciousness concealed here in the evolution, the line of rebirth cannot stop even there. It cannot cease in its ascent before the mental has been replaced by the supramental nature and an embodied supramental being becomes the leader of terrestrial existence. From this small paragraph, there is another very important thing that arises, which is also, you know, in terms of the yoga of Sri Aurobindo, very important to understand and realize, which is that we are called upon not merely, you see, there is, of course, you know, in this yoga, it's such a vast and complex yoga that, you know, even if we achieve one small aspect of the yoga in a lifetime, it is still a great achievement. If somebody gets the psychic transformation, or why the psychic transformation, even the experience of the psychic being as an independent entity that has temporal eternity to it, if we can have a good full possession of that, that is already a tremendous achievement. Now, that is often emphasized as the first need in this yoga. And that is done because that is the center of our existence, and also because that is the sure safety in our path. To the extent that the psychic can come to the front, we can be safe from all the various pitfalls and dangers of yoga. But we cannot stop there, nor can we make that our only goal. We have to open up these other possibilities. And as he's pointing out, the very meaning of rebirth is to open up greater possibilities of human nature and of human manifestation. Therefore, to open up the higher ranges of the mind in our present existence, to embody them, to manifest them, should also be part of our evolutionary journey in the integral yoga.
Rosemary, do you want to read the next one?
Yes. This then is the rational and philosophical foundation for a belief in rebirth. It is an inevitable logical conclusion if there exists at the same time an evolutionary principle in the Earth's nature and the reality of the individual soul born into evolutionary nature. If there is no soul, then there can be mechanical evolution without necessity or significance, and Earth is only part of this curious but senseless machinery. If the individual is only a temporary formation beginning and ending with the body, then evolution can be a play of the also or cosmic existence, mounting sure progression of higher and higher species towards its own utmost possibility in this becoming or to its highest conscious principle. Rebirth does not exist and is not needed as a mechanism of that evolution. Or if the all existence expresses itself in a persistent but illusory individuality, rebirth becomes a possibility or an illusory fact, but it has no evolutionary necessity. It is not a spiritual necessity. It is only a means of accentuating and prolonging the illusion up to its utmost time limit. If there is an individual soul of Purusha not dependent on the body, but inhabiting and using it for its purpose, then rebirth begins to be possible. But it is not a necessity if there is no evolution of the soul in nature. The presence of the individual soul in an individual body may be a passing phenomenon. A single experience without a future. Its past and its future may be elsewhere. But if there is an evolution of consciousness in an evolutionary body, and the soul inhabiting the body, a real and conscious individual, then it is evident that it is the progressive experience of that soul in nature which takes the form of this evolution of consciousness. Rebirth is self-evidently a necessary part, the sole possible machinery of such an evolution. It is as necessary as birth itself, and it is as necessary as birth itself. For without it, birth would be an initial step without a sequel, the starting of a journey without its further steps and arrival. It is rebirth that gives to the birth of an incomplete being in a body its promise of completeness and its spiritual significance.
So here in this last paragraph, Sri Aurobindo really ties up all the threads and gives you a summary of what he has presented in this entire chapter, which is that there are two necessities for this philosophy of rebirth to be logical and rational. And these two necessities are the two fundamental intuitions we have and experiences we have. One of an evolving cosmos in which not only forms but consciousness itself is evolving in a universal manner. And the other in the emergence of the individual as a true person, as a soul that ultimately has some kind of reality closely linked to this evolutionary becoming. That in a sense, an individual is at the center of the bid for the possession of consciousness in this evolving universe. So he goes through the various scenarios in very brief over here, and we see the arguments that he has introduced to show us the inevitability, the necessary and sufficient conditions for this philosophy of rebirth to be true. First, he takes up what one might call the materialist view. That is that cosmic evolution, but here the cosmic evolution is just an evolution of forms, and there is no need for a soul, leave alone that of rebirth. But there the individual is only serving a mechanical purpose. As he says, if there is no soul, then there can be a mechanical evolution without necessity or significance. And birth is only part of this curious but senseless machinery. The second option he takes up is that there is an evolution of consciousness in the universe, but that individuals, if they have a soul, have that soul in a temporary fashion. It is what our phenomenological experience shows us, that there is a certain kind of evolutionary movement, but human beings appear and disappear. They are replaced by other human beings, and whatever individuality there was is only a temporary bubble that appears and then is gone forever. So here he is saying, in the second case, if the individual is only a temporary formation beginning and ending with the body, then evolution, still there is an evolution. Evolution can be a play of the all soul or cosmic existence mounting through a progression of higher and higher species towards its own utmost possibility in this becoming, or to its highest conscious principle. Rebirth does not exist and is not needed as a mechanism of that evolution. In other words, if it was only an evolution of cosmic Purusha or of cosmic Prakriti, moving from grade to grade of consciousness and creating forms in which there is no central enduring person, then there is no need either for a soul or for the evolution of a soul, that is, for rebirth. Then he goes on to talk about, maybe there is an all existence, but that all existence just projects itself from life to life without there being any evolution. So first two options he has taken are evolution of consciousness. First is evolution of forms. Second is universal evolution of consciousness, without, in each case, without any soul present. Third case is there is no evolution of consciousness, but there is a soul. However, the soul is only an appearance, an illusory appearance taken on by some transcendental all existence in a certain kind of meaningless play in which it repeats this illusory reality from life to life. So he says, or if the all existence expresses itself in a persistent but illusory individuality, the rebirth becomes a possibility or an illusory fact, but it has no evolutionary necessity and is not a spiritual necessity. It is only a means of accentuating and prolonging the illusion up to its utmost time limit. So this is, one may say, the Advaitic view of existence and the illusory reality of the Atman. Then he goes on to talk about, if there is an individual soul of Purusha not dependent on the body, but inhabiting and using it for its purpose, then rebirth begins to be possible. Okay, so now it's not really an illusory on all existence creating illusory forms of the soul, but a reality to the soul, some real projection of the Supreme Self as the soul. But such a soul may exist in an evolutionary reality, because it has an eternal actual reality, but it may find itself in a non-evolutionary universe. Okay, so if the universe is not evolutionary, but the soul is real, then rebirth is possible, but it is not necessary. Okay, so that's the point he's making. Then rebirth begins to be possible by necessity if there is no evolution of the soul in nature. The presence of the individual in an individual body may be a passing phenomenon, a single experience without a past here or a future. In other words, it may have its past and future elsewhere. In other words, its past and its future may be elsewhere. But, so he has exhausted all these possibilities, that there is an evolution, firstly of mechanical forms, then of consciousness, but there is no soul. Secondly, there is no evolution, but there is an illusory persistence of some all existence presenting the appearance of a soul. Next, that there is a reality of a soul but no evolution. Finally, he is going to come to the only option left, which is an evolution of consciousness in an evolutionary body and a soul inhabiting the body, a real and conscious individual. So these are the two conditions to be satisfied. That there is the reality to the individual being, a center of personhood in each individual being, right, evolving from an inchoate condition of personhood to a clarity of personhood, and an evolution of universal nature from grade to grade, in forms and in universal consciousness. If both exist, then it is evident that it is the progressive experience of that soul in nature which takes the form of this evolution of consciousness. Rebirth is self-evidently a necessary part, the sole possible machinery of such an evolution. It is as necessary as birth itself. For without it, birth would be an initial step without a sequel. The starting of a journey without its further steps and arrival. It is rebirth that gives to the birth of an incomplete being in a body its promise of completeness and its spiritual significance. So here again, in a very radical way, Sri Aurobindo is making the point. Huge machinery of nature and its evolution is only there to serve the growth of the individual person as the self-manifestation of Purushottama in all its innumerable forms in a evolution of nature, ultimately leading to the full possession of this creation in its play. Yeah. So the validation of the theistic reality of the Supreme Being becoming in the universe.
That was quite a chapter. Should we take a logical break and start next week, or do we want to?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We can start next week with the next chapter. Yeah, if there's any other comments or questions anybody wants to make, we can take that up here. I also wanted to pass on the communication that Anjali ji made to me today, which is that this Friday, maybe for some time, Kirit ji's last address to us, because he is going through a certain big change and has to move from Delhi to Ahmedabad this Sunday. There is a commission which he has accepted, so he is going to be working with the Gujarat government as an educational sort of consultant, or the head of the educational sort of division of the Gujarat government, and so he is going to move to Ahmedabad this Sunday. All this happened very suddenly, so he has asked us to hold on until he can settle down a little bit and resume the study that he has initiated with us. So this Friday will be our last visit for some time with him.
Devashish, excuse me.
Yes.
I was wondering, Kareet's kind of active still. Isn't he rather elderly at this point?
Yeah, in technical terms, he's elderly, but he's still very, very active, and particularly his consciousness is still very young.
Good.
Oops. Yeah.
Devashishtha.
Yes,
in this chapter, the rebirth, you know, from whatever sense I got of it, in terms of a future, does it also mean that at some point, you know, when the whole world of Vidya is sort of comes under the divine influence,
yes,
at some point the whole universal reality as we see around us is likely to get, you know, under the influence of the Purushottama, and
yes,
as a huge personalized being, you know, have a poise like that. I mean, I got this sense of a hugeness that is, you know, not just title, but something that has divine within it and self-conscious divine, not just the human beings, but the whole universal, you know, cosmos.
Yes.
I don't know, it would be interesting sense, you know. So, I mean, what would you say?
Yes, it's very profound what you're touching on, and you know, that's the reason why Purushottama, you know, Purushottama is ultimately embodied in the true principles of its being in the Vishwarup Darshan. And that is where you see that, you know, exactly what you talked about, the enormous complexity and the totality of being and of becoming, with all its forms and all of its formlessness coexisting. As a reality, that sense of that kind of divine being, that sense of a divine person who has that kind of quality, as the player in time, so to say, and our partaking of that reality, our partaking of that experience, and our knowledge of the identity of that experience. So in a way, you see, Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is foreshadowing a kind of an integral Vaishnavism, you may say, that is never is has never really fully been expressed anywhere, but you know he hints at it because it is so far beyond our present condition that we can only talk about it in symbols at this point. But yes, it is a kind of a, you know, a enormity of experience, which just is totally baffling, and that is where the evolution, universal cosmic evolution, is leading outside the avidya, out of the avidya, into a play of that kind, of beings that have that kind of experience of divinity and of the self.
Of the self as well, yeah.
Yeah, of the self as well.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Yes. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just want to share a link with Kirit's writings. I just sent it in the chat. There are some of his writings I found interesting about Vedic Rishis and all that.
Debashi?
Yeah, thank you for sending that. I think that in that Auroville website, there's some very nice writings of his. Yes, Shyam, you were saying something.
When all this knowledge is not native to the consciousness, could you give some tips on how it is possible to hold that in our being? I mean, I guess it's kind of we are mentally constructing the model and holding it. But there are probably good ways and lousy ways of doing it.
I can't hear you, Shyam. I think you were getting, sort of your voice was getting chopped up. Can you repeat your question again?
Yeah. So what I was asking, is it better now? Hello?
Yes, it's much better now.
Yeah. So what I was asking was when the consciousness does not have a native possession of this knowledge, what are some ways to hold it in our minds with more and more certainty rather than haziness?
Yeah, it's a very good question because, a lot of what Sri Aurobindo points to is totally beyond our present experience. And, you know, we can again think of these in terms of, you know, the known, the knowable, and the unknowable, almost like that. Because there are certain things within our possibility of experience, and some things which are possible to experience but beyond the possibility of our experience. So, you see, we have to approach all these things differently. And at this point, you see, there are two faculties that we can use. One faculty is the mind, and there it pays to develop whatever kind of conceptual model that we can of this. But knowing fully well that it is just a conceptual model, it helps us, just as Shastra helps us, in not letting us go astray. If you have clarity of conception, then one thing that you can be sure of is that it will come in to guide you to point that something that you are experiencing is not necessarily what you want to experience. See, I mean, you know, if you will not jump to a certain conclusion if you know that certain other possibilities exist. So that it is very useful from that point of view. And as a result, this is, I think, a very key point. It has also impact on the other great, you know, faculty that is given to us. And that is our aspiration. You see, we all have an aspiration, and the aspiration starts off just as we talk about psychic entity and psychic being. Aspiration, which is one of the powers of the psychic being, is also similarly something which starts off without much form. it starts off as a certain kind of a very vague, you know, sort of wish, a vague, you know, sort of call to something higher, a possibility that we are not clear about. You know, something that wished but knew not how to be, you know, just as Sri Aurobindo defines it.
Beautiful.
In the symbol dawn in Savitri. That is the nature of aspiration in the human being to start with. But as we develop a clarity of conception, that also has some resonance on the psychic aspiration. Psychic aspiration also becomes more fine-tuned and becomes more precise in its own seeking. And that is what brings to it what it looks for. You see, so that is the reason, largely the reason why, you know, getting a clarity of vision regarding what is possible and what is desirable is extremely important in yoga. That is one aspect, very important aspect. And the other thing, of course, third thing, apart from forming a mental conception and making the aspiration more precise, is that it opens us to knowledge above the mind. It is again exactly as Sri Aurobindo is saying, that humanity exists to express and embody forms of consciousness that it still has not experienced, that are not native to it. So here, what we find, this is, to me, reading Sri Aurobindo is a darshan, because in a sense, this texts of this kind put us directly into contact with what we haven't experienced. But the power of experience of those things are already here. See, the words that are being given to you is not speculation, nor is it just a possibility by somebody who's caught a glimpse. But it is words of power given by somebody with the experience of exactly what he is talking about. That puts us into contact with that in a way much greater than if we were just trying to conceive of it. So it makes active, in a sense, sheaths of, you know, being that are, you know, in some sense, not yet available to us, but which exist in us. So that is, I think, these are the various, you know, sort of ways in which we can utilize this knowledge. We can form a conception, we can open ourselves to the power of experience in it, and we can make more precise our aspiration as we proceed in our yoga.
Thank you, Devashishta. Very nice. Thank you.
Shall we end with the meditation?
Okay.